good afternoon, everyone. My name is Representative Patty Fritz, and I represent part of Rice and Steele County in District 26B, and I'm a member of the Nursing Home Working Group, along with others here at the table who are also members of the Nursing Home Working Group. And I want to thank you members for coming during this summer to St. Paul, although it's very nice and comfortable in here compared to that hot, humid weather outside. So I hope everyone is comfortable, and I hope that we're able to all come together again. We met as a working group throughout the session, and we're most all of us, actually, our legislators, not all of us, serve on health committees. For the most part, I think the ones who are here today do, however, and we wanted to form the Nursing Home Working Group because of the nursing home issues that plague all of us, and we certainly saw that became a very important issue at the state legislature last year. So we've come together, we got the pot boiling, I think, pretty hot last year. We were certainly disappointed with what we brought home to our nursing homes, but we want to continue to meet and to continue to share and gather information, and hopefully find some solutions for our nursing homes and our loved ones who reside in them. So I've just introduced myself, and I'm just going around. If we could introduce the members of the Nursing Home Working Group, also Representative Bly has joined us, and Representative Teason. So I'll start with you, Representative Teason. If you could just introduce yourself, we'll go around for short introductions, please.
Hi, I'm Paul Teason. I'm a state representative from Minneapolis.
Sandra Erickson, I'm a state representative from House District 60A, which is East Central Minnesota, Princeton, Foley, Malacca, Onania, Isle.
I'm Representative David Bly from Northfield and Belle Plaine, and my interest is because of the nursing homes in my district.
Sam
Hawkey,
Belle Plaine.
Randy Sun,
Paul Teason.
Hendrick Newton, Julian Ford, Linda Cabrera of GOP, Paul Teason.
I'm Representative Larry Hosh, and I represent Central Minnesota and Stearns County, including the communities of St. Joseph, Cold Spring, Painesville, Richmond, Eden Valley, Kimball, Fairhaven, Avon, and I think that's every one of them.
And I'm Kent Eakin, State Representative for District 2A up in northwest Minnesota, and that includes the counties of Norman, Manoman, Becker, Polk, and Clearwater.
I'm Jen McNartney. I'm the committee administrator for the Health and Human Services Policy Committee, and I'm staffing this working group.
Thank you all for coming today, and as I said earlier, I'm Representative Patty Fritz, and I spent most of my adult life in the nursing home industry as a licensed practical nurse. And we have presenters here today, and our first presenter, Mr. Held, has also spent a great deal of time on this issue, and I want to welcome you, Mr. Held, to our working group committee today, and thank you for all of your service to us, and this will be very interesting, and thank you for the overview that you will be giving. We've asked Mr. Held to give us sort of the evolution of the nursing home rate and how things started and where they are and how they ended up where they are today. So please say your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'm Bob Held from the Department of Human Services. I was going to ask you if this is some like formal testimony or just a meeting.
Well, I guess it is being taped, but it's still informal.
Okay. We compared notes the other day, I've had 34 years working in long-term care. And what I'm going to talk about today is really getting down to, a variety of reimbursement issues, but the main issue is how did the rates get to be what they are today? And it's gone through any number of steps. However, back as far back as I wanted to go to be relevant, in 1979 or thereabouts, the state instituted what was called Rule 49. In 1985, moved to Rule 50. In 1995 began what's called APS. I'll move beyond acronyms shortly. And in 2007, the legislature enacted a law calling for rebasing. And I'm going to bring us up to that point in describing these steps. And I'm not going to talk about property portion of the payment rate. I'm really only going to be talking in much detail about the operating portion. And operating and property are very different. Operating has to do with the staff, the supplies, the things that it takes to run the nursing home from day to day. Property is the capital costs of the building, property, the land improvements, major building improvements, major equipment. But that's what we mean by property. So what was Rule 49? Well, Rule 49 was a cost-based reimbursement system that allowed it developed an operating payment rate based on what last year's costs actually were. However, it had additional considerations. It allowed an increase for what was called unknown cost increases. In other words, it assumed that there would be some cost increases that would take place, but it also allowed facilities to file for an increase in their payment rate based on cost increases they knew would take place, known cost increases. And then there was a retroactive settle-up at the end of the year. So it was kind of a retrospective system that pretty much covered what the costs were, subject to some limitations that were built into that system. The state, my best recollection from 22 years ago, is that the state felt that Rule 49 was too inflationary, that the increases were way beyond what normal inflation was, and so they made some revisions to that and moved into what they called Rule 50. Rule 50 is also cost-based. Facility files a cost report under Rule 50 for a reporting period of a year, and that would be a year ending September 30th, any given year. And then the costs in that report would be used to generate a rate for the following July 1st for a year. The Rule 50 used geographic-based limits. It divided the state into three geographic groups. You can see them on this map. The metro group is in blue, and then there was a group called, I guess it was called Deep Rural, Geographic Group 1, and Geographic Group 2 is in red, and that's in the middle. I would, by the way, want to give credit for that visual to a gentleman sitting there with the tie on, Todd Bergstrom. I plagiarized it, but I guess it's not plagiarism if you give credit. So geographic groups were used to set cost limits, and the way that worked was that a statistical measure was taken of the costs reported within the facilities for each geographic group, and that measure was used to set a limit to what the rate could be. So if the facilities in, say, Deep Rural had lower average spending, the measure would come out lower, and then the limit, which was based on that measure, would also be lower. That was how limits were set, to keep everybody relatively close to the median. The rate was prospective, which means that you knew in advance of the year what your rate was going to be, and if your costs were greater or less than that rate, there was no settle-up, there was no payback, there was no pay-in of additional costs. It was simply to say, this is what your rate's going to be, that's what it is, and that's it. So the known cost increases, the unknown cost increases, the settle-up went away with Rule 50. Rule 50 recognized inflation. So it took the cost year, and it added 21 months of inflation, which brought you from the midpoint of the cost year through the 9-month gap from October 1 to June 30th, and then 6 more months to the midpoint of the rate year, 21 months. And the costs were inflated by that much to reflect that. Therefore, if a facility chose to spend more than what their historic cost as inflated would allow for, they could do that. And if they did that for a 21-month period, they would be doing what's called a spend-up, and that would result in a rate increase the following year. However, they'd have to do that for the entire reporting year. They'd have to get the costs up and then bear that during the interim 9-month period, and then they would be able to see that rate increase if it didn't put them over the limits. In 1995, the state enacted some sort of a financial budget crisis and enacted some limits on Rule 50 rates beyond what were already there. They enacted what was called a spend-up limit and a high-cost limit. The spend-up limit said you can't go up more than a certain amount, and I didn't study it up carefully, but my recollection is that it had to do with where you were in the array. If you were a low-rate facility, you had a larger spend-up limit than if you were a high-rate facility. And they also enacted high-cost limits, which resulted in some rate reductions for the facilities that were in the upper tier of rates. They still had their inflation, so that they ended up with rate increases that were smaller than they would otherwise have been. Once again, the map, you have that in your handout as well. When the high-cost and spend-up limits were enacted, the legislature also enacted APS, the Alternative Payment System, and that began to be implemented in 1996. The alternative system was voluntary. Facilities that wanted to be in it had to apply. They were selected, and in the beginning it was quite competitive to be part of APS. It changed the relationship between the Department of Human Services, between the state, and the facilities that were in APS by saying, we're going to reimburse you under a contract. And under this contract, the rate setting was also still prescribed by what was the statute, but what would happen would be, we no longer would ask you as a facility to tell us what it costs to operate, and we would not base a rate on your costs. Instead, we would take your rate that was already in place, and on July 1st, we would inflate that based on CPI, Consumer Price Index. So, increases that were known to be coming, increases that were unknown, costs that would go up more than inflation, they would not be considered under APS. You would simply get CPI as a rate adjustment in that program. So then the facilities were relieved of the obligation to file cost reports, and when they went into APS, if it was, it would always occur sometime during the course of a rate year, the rates would stay the same. The existing Rule 50 rates would become the APS rates. The following July 1st, they would be inflated. So that was the whole point of APS. The underlying message of it, I believe, was let's stop micromanaging facilities in every aspect of their costs and what's allowable and what's not allowable. Instead, let's give them what their rate is. Let's give them inflation. They're doing this voluntarily. And let them manage their finances without interference from the state. That was the underlying idea. What actually happened, however, played out a little bit differently from that. First of all, CPI was used for property payment rates. This is probably the only time I'm going to mention property today. CPI was used for that every year, because what the statute says is that the total payment rate would be inflated by, or the property and operating would be inflated by CPI. Nothing's ever changed about that in regard to property. However, in regard to operating, it did play out different every year beginning in 1999. In fact, in 1998, the facilities got their inflation, and then the legislature also provided an additional 3% of compensation-related costs to go entirely toward compensation-related costs. In 1999, the legislature suspended the automatic CPI as regards operating payment rates, and instead said to do a different increase, and they had this very complicated increase that was done that year and the following year. But the bottom line is that it was in fact greater than CPI would have been. And in fact, the department applied that to all facilities rather than just APS facilities. So beginning in 1999, even the Rule 50 facilities were in an APS type model. We'll call it a rate on rate model. That's the term we use for it because it's a rate of inflation, either CPI or established otherwise by the legislation, applied to the existing operating payment rate. That's what happened in 99. That's referring to Federal 99 fiscal year 2000 and 2001. And in fact, the automatic inflation has been suspended every year since then and is currently in statute suspended until 2011, fiscal year 2011, I believe. Every year the legislature has chosen to do something different. They, in most years, did something comparable to or a little bit greater than inflation. There were a couple years where they, in fact, froze payment rates in 03, 04, I believe it was. In 2005, the APS program changed significantly because some property aspects of Rule 50 were adopted for all facilities, and facilities were told that rate increases would apply only to facilities with contracts under APS. So in that sense, legislation encouraged facilities to go into APS by 10106, and all facilities did do that. So today, all facilities are in the alternative system as regards operating. Well, they're in APS.
Okay, can I ask a question?
Yes, that's Senator Houston.
Okay, so when the APS system was put in place, it was going to be the rate they were using and then in place by inflation, and then it would continue by inflation each year going forward, irrespective of cost? Is that starting whatever year you sign the contract, it would just increase by inflation?
Mr. Hill?
Madam Chair, Representative Houston, that's exactly right.
Okay. And so what we're doing now is instead of doing inflation, we're doing whatever percentage COLA increase we choose to use.
Well, and
depending on the year, but...
Yeah, and that's what the legislature's actually done every year beginning in 99.
Okay.
Thank you. So, rates are different. Every facility will have rates that are based on what their costs were for an APS contract beginning in 99 or 98 or 97 or 96, and go back a year or so to a base year. And so for the first facilities in APS, their rate today is a function of what their costs were in about 1995, 12 or 13 years ago. And that rate was determined in part for some facilities based on the limits that were in place. So because their costs were different and their limits were different depending on the geographic group they were in, the rates today would be different. Many of you may have heard me testify in describing various proposals about payment system reform that we view this as a broken system. So if you find the system disturbing in those characteristics, I'm not the person to argue with you about that. So that's our rates between facilities different? Yes. Every facility's rates are going to be somewhat different from every other facility. A question that I was asked to talk about is whether there's disparity in those rates. And we have attempted to analyze this. The information I have was done prior to the 07 session. This first table shows you the standard deviation of payment rates, operating payment rates, divided by the average of those payment rates. It's kind of a weird statistic. But what we were trying to get at with this graph was to determine if the disparities were getting bigger or smaller between facilities. And a measure of how different things are is the standard deviation. Well, the problem with that measure is if you double the standard deviation, but the rates also doubled, then the disparities didn't really change. So that's why it's divided by the average. And what you can see is that the disparities in fact, were declining in 2000, 2001, 2002, and that would appear to be because the legislature did take some affirmative actions in those years to reduce disparities. There were some increases that were provided to facilities that had the lowest rates. Those increases happened to be depending on whether the facility was metro or non-metro, and that gets to the next disparity issue, which is the question of, are these disparities related to geography? And what this table does is it answers that question with a yes. The red line, the top one, shows group two, the not deeper but rural group. What is the average rate in that group compared with group three metro? And you can see that it's approached being equal, but it's only gotten up to about 88%. It was around 84%, came up, and seems to be softening just slightly relative to that. The blue line, the lower line, is a comparison of geographic group one as a percent of geographic group three. And that was on the original slide. For some reason, when I copied it, I heard that part wouldn't copy. Tried it several times and gave up. But what you've got is that you can see that the average operating payment rate in geographic group one, deep rural, is low, and group two is not quite as low, and group three is higher than those two. On average, that does not mean to say that there will not be a group three facility with rates that are lower than groups one and two averages. There are, but the average is that it's lower, and I think that that's a pretty meaningful measure to the question of, are there geographic disparities? So I was going to talk about some other reimbursement-related issues that I think are important background, if I may. However, I should see if there's any questions about the more basic rate-setting piece before I do that.
Yes, thank you. Do any of the members have any questions for Mr. Held on the information he's given us so far? The Representative Otremba. Would you introduce yourself, Marilyn? At the beginning of Rule 50, there's a 1995 at the end of Rule 50. What was the date? What year was that Rule 50 came in place?
Madam Chair, Representative Trumbull, what I was trying to convey was that Rule 50 was initiated in 1985.
Okay.
Yeah. It's actually still in force in regard to some property assets.
Okay. Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm. Representative Thiessen.
What steps were taken to reduce the geographic disparities in the early part of the decade? Was this rate increase at a higher...
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, what the legislature enacted was, I would characterize it as a set of rate floors. And what the legislation did is it had a separate floor for each case mix level and for metro and for rural. And that was for rates beginning in 7101 and then another set of floors for 7102. And that year, the COLA, or each of those 2 years, the COLA was 3% on the operating payment rate. And what the legislation said was that in combination with the COLA, facilities could have rate increases that would bring them up to the floor, but limited to 10% total. Mm-hmm. So that for each of the 2 years, some facilities got as much as an additional 7%.
Mm-hmm. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Held, in 2005, we enacted the Stearns-Benton-Sherburn change in reimbursement rate. So they joined the Metro. And that took effect then in 2006 when we enacted it again, because for some reason, the department did not follow through, and we don't need to discuss that. But if we continue down this road of piecemeal by county, you know, adding to Metro, because I carried a bill, I know Representative Frick carried a bill, and we were, you know, looking at our individual areas and trying, because they do adjoin Metro, make them a metro rate reimbursement. But to what extent is that piecemeal going to further cause disparity, do you think?
Mr. Hill.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, well, my first thought is if we were to do three counties every year, we could get the job done in only 27 years. Here.
27.
Or 28, but it's something like 27 or 20 years. What happened was that the, I don't remember the names of all the counties, but the counties adjacent to Benton, Stearns, and Sherburne counties, especially homes that were in close proximity to those, they began to feel like they had a problem. And you're representing
mm-hmm.
those.
Malachi.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it mm-hmm. it may have solved a problem in three counties, mm-hmm. but it didn't necessarily have a statewide effect. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
That's exactly what I thought. Yes.
Representation.
Just one further on the geographic disparities. Are there geographic disparities that would, in costs, that would justify some of this percentage? Some of these disparities in reimbursement rates?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, nursing homes, like any other business, are limited on what they can spend.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some pretty good evidence that they're spending more than their Medicaid rate would support today.
Wherever they are.
That they're spending reserves. They're using money that they bring in outside of that payment rate in ways that are operating costs that, if we were cost-based, would become part of the rate. But for a great deal of their costs, they're limited by what their revenues are. And so if the revenues are differently limited, the costs ultimately will be. That doesn't mean that they can easily do that or do it justly. For example, wages in different parts of the state also differ. I don't have data on that with me, but we do collect that data, and we use it under a different statute related to SNSA's Supplemental Nursing Service Agency, where the amount that they can charge a nursing home is limited, and it's limited to 150% of the weighted average wage for a particular discipline in their geographic group. And geographic group has higher limits, has higher wages than geographic groups 1 and 2 and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, what I think your question comes down to is the cost of living in one part of the state particularly different from another part of the state, particularly for somebody who's making $8 to $10 an hour? I don't know. We tried to analyze what would be a good basis for recognizing that costs are different on a geographic basis. I was never very satisfied with anything we came up with looking at MSAs, metropolitan statistical areas, or economic development regions. Looking at, if you look at nursing home wage spending, it's kind of a circular argument. If you look at spending in other areas, like if you looked at the average wage rate paid in the metropolitan economic development region, it's certainly higher than it is in other parts of the state. And in some cases, it's quite a bit higher. But there's probably different professions active in different parts of the state that are driving it. Certain types of activities are probably more concentrated in the metro area that pay higher than the kinds of professions in other counties or other economic development regions. A lot of daily living costs are the same,
mm-hmm.
perhaps higher in rural areas. The only other thing I can mm-hmm. say on that, I think, is that the rebasing proposal that was adopted, which was an industry recommendation, contains the industry
mm-hmm.
Solution to the problem, which is three geographically based groups. Now they're called peer groups. they're not the same exact definition as Rule 50.
Thank you. Representative Eakin.
Thank you. And it sounds to me like you're saying that there's not a lot of justification for the different groups as far as geographic regions are concerned. You haven't seen much evidence as far as cost of living is concerned that would justify the differentiation in the rates between the different geographic regions. Would that be a correct assessment?
Madam Chair, Representative Eakin, what I'm really trying to convey is that we haven't been able to identify within the department, to our satisfaction, a way of looking at the issue, a way of analyzing it and determining a good response to it. I can't tell you that there isn't a basis for geographic distinctions, but I can't tell you there isn't how to do it either.
Thank you.
One more question. What about when they were doing cost-based billing? And maybe that data is just too old to be of any use to us today. But when, before the APS, they were filing costs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was there any? You should have had a sense then about what nursing home costs would be, I would imagine, or would the same analysis still apply that because reimbursement rates were lower than costs, it still held down the real cost of providing nursing home services?
I think it's the latter. I think that the rate is strongly influencing costs, and so to base the limits solely on what those costs are could be, it risks becoming circular, I think.
Okay.
There was one other point that I have a feeling I'm about to lose, but in regard to Representative Erickson's question about the St. Cloud and the disparities, a big problem there isn't just that this set of counties and that set of counties may have different average rates, but when a facility's rate is determined by the state and another facility's rate is also determined by the state and they're very different rates and those facilities are in close proximity to each other, now you've got a problem because you're creating a situation. And this can even happen within a county where one facility is in a much stronger position because they've just had higher historic rates and they continue to have higher rates. But when it's geographically related, our feeling was that there's something that can be done about that. And in fact, the rebasing legislation did adopt a sort of a gray zone concept, mm-hmm. creating a 20-mile thing where there would be some blending, mm-hmm. depending on how close the two facilities are. If they're across the lines, are affected by different limits.
Mm-hmm. Representative Erdahl had a question next. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Held, first of all, I want to thank you and commend you for working on this over the years with me, who's tried to come up with the various solutions so far unsuccessfully that we've been trying. And you reference those nursing homes that are in close proximity, and I know that you are aware of this, but perhaps some others are not, where I have one nursing home in Watkins, and then there's another nursing home in Painesville, owned by the same company, within about less than 10 miles of each other, and one gets $15 about more per resident per day.
Mm-hmm.
And if that Watkins home were to move 50 feet to the north, it would be getting the same amount of money as the Painesville home. Yeah, well, it'd be in Representative Hosh's district where the sun shines all the time anyway.
Obviously.
As I notice the top of his head right now. But we need to do something with these rates. And I guess I'm asking if you can envision a time where there is just one rate for the state, and if there is a way to achieve that. One of the things we were trying to do last time was to establish a floor and then raise everyone up to that level so that it would narrow the disparity gap. But I'm sure last session and future sessions will continue to run into a difficulty where if you don't do something to raise that top, it's difficult to get legislative support. So perhaps as rates go up, we have to raise the top level at a slower rate than the other levels until eventually they catch up and we are, you know, close the gap completely. Do you think that that's possible?
Mr. Held.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, you're welcome. It's good working with you on that endeavor. I would argue that having all nursing homes with equal rates would not be necessarily the best way to allocate the available funds. My saying that is premised on the notion that I'm not going to quarrel on the issue of whether or not nursing homes could do better with more resources. I think they probably could. How much more for everybody to do as good as they could do? Who knows? I think the problem we face in a context of competing resources, because we're talking about all kinds of things that you guys have to make funding decisions about besides nursing homes. I think one of the key problems is with the amount of resources that ultimately are available, how can we do the best job that we can do? And I don't think a strategy of putting everybody at an equal rate would accomplish that. I think that there are legitimate reasons why some facilities should have a higher rate than others. Case mixes, I think, assumed as part of that discussion, so the fact that a facility might have higher acuity is not just what I'm referring to. I think that there are probably legitimate reasons why it costs more to operate in one area than in another. I think that there's a certain justice, a certain wisdom in having a system that at least in part is cost-based, which is what we're moving toward now. I also believe that when the state is spending well in excess of $400 million a year from the general fund for something, that it ought to take quality into consideration. And that there ought to be some ways in which higher quality is encouraged through that payment system. We, in fact, have some of those, at least on a temporary basis, today. We have a quality add-on. On 10106, the quality add-on was up to 2.4% of the operating payment rate, averaged about 1%. On 10107, it will be up to 0.3%. I think those are good investments because it makes not only a moral statement and it has a reputation effect for facilities, but it actually gets attention and causes people to say, how are you measuring this quality and how can I do better at that? We think that's really important. All that said, and one other thing is that the new system has an aspect that says the limits in the new rebasing system will be a function of quality as well once it's phased in, if certain tests are met. So all that said, should rates be equal? I don't think so. I think what we need to be looking for is a way to use the rate setting system to accomplish the best we can accomplish.
Representative Erdahl.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Held, that's fine if that's the direction that the department is thinking is best to go, and maybe you are already going to do what I suggest, but or have already planned to. But I would say if it's cost based or whatever, that the current system be wiped clean and you start over, because going on history basically simply perpetuates the formula that you had before, which I think is has led to a lot of inequality. So I would be urging that you wipe the slate clean and set the rates based on that.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Mr. Held.
Representative Erdahl, I think that there was a package that was under consideration in 2007. It included rebasing, going to a cost-based system. It included quality aspects in it. And separate from that were any number of proposals to address race disparities, one of which was yours. I can only react to it on a sort of a personal level that I thought the idea of doing something separate, having a separate set of resources to assist the low-rate homes to be in a better position to move into this cost-based, quality-based model had a certain, I'll characterize as niftiness about it. We certainly didn't have a quarrel about doing that. But where you come down is you're going to support existing patterns of spending, probably. You're going to support COLAs. You're going to support transition to a new system. Mm-hmm. You're going to support disparities, and then you're going to take all of those competing interests just within nursing homes and everything outside of that and have to weigh them and ultimately come up with a decision on where to go.
Thank you, Mr. Heldon. If you could continue with your presentation, we just have a few minutes left for you.
There was several other topics I wanted to talk about, Madam Chair. I wanted to just touch base very quickly on each of these. Rate equalization. Minnesota is almost unique in having what's called a rate equalization law. What this says is that the amount that a nursing home can charge to a person who is private pay cannot exceed the rates set by the state for Medicaid. There is an exception for private rooms in that, saying that essentially if a person is private pay in a private room, the facility can charge any amount in addition to that. There's also special service considerations in there. If you have a special service that you want to charge more, you have to make that available to everybody in the facility at the same price. And there are protections against discrimination as part of rate equalization. Minnesota also has case mix. We've had this since we moved into Rule 50 in 1985. In 2002, we transitioned from a state-only, a Minnesota-specific method of accounting for acuity to what's called RUGS, the Resource Utilization Groups system. It's a federally designed system that has a lot more groups and is probably a little less intuitive, but has a little better scientific basis for it. It does a better job predicting actual differences based on acuity. We did a staff time measurement study a couple years ago, and we're preparing to adopt those indices this coming January. The legislature, in adopting rebasing, adopted those as part of the phase-in of rebasing. The indices in case mix tell you that a portion of the operating payment rate related to direct care should be higher for a person that has certain characteristics than for another person that doesn't have those types of characteristics. In about 2001, Minnesota implemented a scholarship program for nursing homes. A couple years later, or about two, 3 years ago, implemented a similar program for home and community-based services. This is for nursing homes, is a cost-based system. We kind of primed the pump, giving everybody a quarter per resident day to be used for scholarships. They could do whatever they wanted, but when a certain period of time ended, they would file how much they actually spent on scholarships, and that spending divided by resident days would equal their new rate. So there's no limit on this. Some facilities don't use any of it. They don't have a scholarship rate anymore. Other facilities have a scholarship rate in excess of a dollar. They can use scholarships as a recruitment and retention tool as well as a workforce building tool. We've had thousands of people get their training while working in a nursing home to become nurses going through that program now. The money in that program is limited to tuition, books, mandatory fees, and it's for a course of study for advancement in the home or in the field of long-term care. Mm-hmm. There was a little bit of discussion about Minnesota's surcharge at the beginning of the legislative session. You can see on the slide a little bit of history of the surcharge. The operating payment rate has always had a component associated with the costs of paying the surcharge. Achieving the full revenue necessary from that rate to pay the surcharge requires that a facility have a relatively high occupancy level. Mm-hmm. And then the state also has had some fairly active strategies, really going back to the early 80s, having to do with rebalancing long-term care, which means shifting the focus of where long-term care services are provided to the location where a consumer wants to have their service, which usually is in their home, and people would prefer not to have to go to the nursing home if it isn't absolutely necessary. Well, by building up the home and community-based service infrastructure, by funding it adequately, you make alternatives increasingly available. In addition, the state has programs to encourage nursing homes to take beds out of active service, either lay them away, making them inactive, and there are certain financial advantages that they can get for doing that or delicensing those beds. But there's additional advantages if they go through the plan closure program that was enacted in 2001, and if they're also creating a single bed as part of eliminating a bed from licensure, there's additional incentives called the single bed incentive that are available. And then I think the final topic I was going to talk about is the report card. This is done cooperatively between the Department of Human Services and the Minnesota Department of Health. It's on the Health Department's website. You've got the address there. And the idea is to create some transparency about quality, to use some standard measures of quality across all nursing facilities in the state. It allows them to benchmark their quality, and it allows a consumer who is looking for a nursing home to consider quality when they make a selection, or if they're already using a nursing home, to consider quality in their advocacy activities that they might engage in within the nursing home. The report card uses 7 measures today, and when a user of the report card makes a query, they specify some geography, and then they tell us, of those 7 measures, which ones are most important to me. And what this chart shows you is, for a couple different periods of time, how those quality measures were ranked. What you'll see is that the most important measures have to do with the quality of life measure and the MDH, the survey inspection, and the clinical quality indicators based on resident assessment. Those are the 3 that have consistently been rated as the most important to report card users. The report card gets about 1,500 to 2,000 queries per month. That's the count of unique visitors. So it's getting a lot of use.
A lot of need out there.
Any other questions for me?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't want to take too much time, but on this, can you just explain the surcharge in a couple more sentences?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen. The surcharge is a bed tax. And what it says is that every licensed facility must pay a fee, a tax, to the state of a certain number of dollars per bed on an annual basis. It's divided into a monthly payment. That fee is currently $2,815. It's about, what is that, about $7.75, I believe, per bed per year, or on a daily basis. The associated with that, the state has provided rate increases. Those rate increases have taken into account the fact that Medicare doesn't pay the rate reset, that vacant bed days aren't paid. And so those rate increases have typically been larger than the actual increase. Does that
answer?
Oh, there's one other thing that maybe you're interested in knowing. Why would the state pay more to collect this fee? That is curious. And the reason is that when we use Medicaid money to pay the increase, that money is half coming out of the state share and half is federal money. And so there's a federal piece, and there's also a private pay element. The private pay people are paying that. The state benefit of the surcharge to the general fund is, I want to say, around $65 million a year.
And mainly because of the Medicaid match?
Because of federal and private pay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Representative Erickson. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Held, I had forgotten why it is that nursing homes connected to hospitals have different rates. Can you review that for me? Mr. Held.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson. In Rule 50, there was a there were provisions that allowed certain facilities to have higher spending limits. And those certain facilities were either hospital-attached, short length of stay facilities, or Rule 80 facilities. There's four Rule 80s. Those are facilities that have a specialty of caring for non-geriatric disabled adults, of younger adults. My recollection is that the limits were something like 110% of the otherwise available limit for care-related costs, and I think 105% for other operating costs.
Hi. Do you know further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Held, very good information. And now we have John Lips and Carrie Zerl from Long-Term Care Imperative. Please come up. Lips, welcome. Yes.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. For the record, my name is John Lips. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for Care Providers of Minnesota. And our association collaborates with my colleagues' association under the auspices of the Long-Term Care Imperative. So our handout is not electronic, but in hard copy, you should have a color printout. And the logo that you see on the first page reflects that collaboration.
And just by way of introduction, Madam Chair, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance. And thank you again for the opportunity to present today.
Well, thank you for coming, both of you. And please go ahead and give us your presentation.
Okay, we will. We'll be as brief as possible. We want to reserve time for the other speakers, especially Ms. Vincent and her colleagues. We weren't exactly sure specifically what you wanted to hear about today, so I don't think this is the mark by some measure. Please let us know and we can take any specific questions that you have. We decided to approach this by just listing three of the general questions that our memberships are considering over the interim period between legislative sessions. There are many ways to phrase these questions, and there are many questions besides these, but what's listed on the second slide are just those three questions. What do facilities need in the short term and the near term? How can we help facilities to change themselves into the thing that we know consumers want in the future and to the thing that nursing facilities, many of them, would like to be in the future? And then another question, which is just a little more nuanced, and I don't know that we have good solutions to this question, but it's important to us about how we integrate the payment stream. So dollars that go into long-term, into skilled facilities and into home and community-based services need to be viewed somehow at the same time to understand how what incentives are being created by doing that. And then also there's an issue that we've grappled with for a long time that the Department of Finance so far has said it's not really feasible to solve, but we wish it was, which is to say that we think there are times when having someone cared for in a skilled nursing facility would save money to the Medicaid program overall if that person could be discharged from a hospital sooner than he or she otherwise would be. And if there was a way to capture or to recognize that in some instances there could be savings on the hospital side and the acute care side, I think that would be useful to this problem. And I mean it in a way there would be instances when I think the hospitals would agree that actually it would be to their benefit as well to move somebody into a different care setting. So I think it would be acceptable to all. So those are the three questions, and particularly with the third of these questions, we'll try to place some of the payment system questions into a larger policy context if we can. So moving to the third slide then, which just says what do facilities need in the near term, the immediate problem is one that you all know from talking to the nursing facilities in your district, and one that you know from our advocacy last session and all of the data that we brought, which is there's an immediate situation of financial distress for nursing homes. It's demonstrable. We have data, financial survey data that shows that. And you already know that. And so we didn't want to dwell on that too much. It's just it's sort of the elephant in the universe, and so we wanted to talk about it. And a major source of that financial distress from our members' perspective is the level of Medicaid reimbursement that exists. So the fourth slide, in terms of one of the things that we'd like to be able to do is to close the Medicaid funding gap. This is something that, according to a study that was conducted by a national accounting firm called BDO Speedman Accountants and Consultants, this was commissioned by the American Healthcare Association, just in the name of full disclosure, it's a study that, which is the long-term care trade association at the national level. So they commissioned this study. It's been conducted for 5 or 6 years in a row now, and what they've done is they've looked at allowable Medicaid costs as reported in a variety of states, I think 35 or 36 states. Todd, is that right? So they look at allowable Medicaid costs that they've been reported to these various states, and then they compare those with the Medicaid reimbursement that's being paid. And so it's a figure that we were using in our advocacy last session that the shortfall, according to this study, in Minnesota was about $20 a day. That was an estimated figure for 2006, comparing what was paid against the allowable cost. And we've seen just a draft of the report that will make an estimate about 2007. It hasn't been released yet, or we would have brought it for your just for your files, suggests that the number might be closer to $25 per resident per day on the Medicaid side. And this is important, as Mr. Held has already explained. The Medicaid rate is extremely important to nursing homes because the rate that Medicaid pays is also the rate that privately paying residents pay. And so the result of that is a relatively high percentage of the total revenue that a nursing home can earn for providing services is set by the Medicaid rate. So this is just a kind of a reminder about why this issue is so important to us. And the effects, we were asked to talk about the effects of the shortfall, this Medicaid funding shortfall. I'll leave it to our colleagues to tell in more personal detail what it's like in their building, and Representative Fritz, you would have anecdotes as well, no doubt. But the slide that's marked number 5 shows a page from a legislative survey that we conduct every year. We survey our memberships jointly. There are typically 250 to 300 nursing facilities that respond to the survey. So it's not every nursing facility in Minnesota, but very representative, I would say. And I know this is a little bit hard to read, but we asked these facilities to check a box against which of the following things they might have done as strategies to try to keep themselves as solvent as possible. Some would say, what are the strategies that you've employed to survive? And you can see there are several of the larger numbers here that are notable and important to mention. The largest, as you can see, reads maintained and or increased Medicare Part A revenue, the second from the top, 58.2%. And that just reflects that the Medicare reimbursement rate, which is relatively higher, is extremely important. And so it demonstrates, I think, that our facilities are doing everything they can to maximize Medicare revenue, which is important. It's a state policy that the Department of Human Services pronounces regularly, and with good reason, and it's one that is important to us as well. But it's really important to note, though, that the Medicare, there are cycles in Medicare funding as well. We face one this very sort of month in Washington. Possibly there will be Medicare cuts. And so to show you that the importance of Medicare. Other things that are also difficult to read, the numbers at the beginning with 38, mm-hmm. The first one says tapped into reserves. The second one says reduced non-direct care staff hours, and followed by reduced direct staff care hours. Mm-hmm. And so that's really lamentable. I think everybody in the room would agree, including those that own and operate nursing facilities, that having to reduce staffing hours as a way to manage a funding shortfall is disappointing and unfortunate for all of us. And finally, just to note, 53.2%, third from the bottom, delayed building and physical plant expenditures. And this doesn't mean only major remodeling kinds of efforts, but even simple things that would take some of the tarnish away from the buildings have been forestalled as well. The following chart, which is slide 6, is one that we use to demonstrate particularly kind of another aspect of the workforce crisis. This is our best estimate of what the wage differential is between, for RNs, between nursing facilities and hospitals. The lower number is based on our salary survey, a salary survey that we conduct also jointly every year. And the top number is based on some data, forgive me, I don't know exactly the data source, but my coworker could answer it if you need it, Minnesota Healthcare Cost Information, which I believe is a kind of a collaboration between the Department of Health and the Minnesota Hospital Association. So this just goes to show that one of the many effects of the payment system that our members feel really acutely is a workforce challenge, which exists and is only getting worse, particularly in the rural parts of the state. We have anecdotes, and I'm sure many of your facilities would say the same. They've had DON positions open at length with increasing sign-up bonuses and things like that, and are just not able to find the people they need. And our members, although wages and benefits I know are not, according to all the studies, are not the only thing that's important in terms of employee satisfaction, but our members routinely tell us that recruiting and retaining good staff is very much a function of what they can pay their staff people. So we just wanted to include this slide to emphasize that one of the effects is the workforce challenge as well. And I would just take a second to praise to the heavens, the Nursing Facility Scholarship Program has been extremely important, and I'm glad that Mr. Held mentioned that. We had neglected to include that in our presentation, but it has been really, really important, and we're very grateful for any continued funding of that. Many, many, many people have been able to climb the career ladder because of that program, so it's been extremely important. So the number one issue that we face, although there are many other things we could talk about still, is the Medicaid funding shortfall. I know it's a tired refrain, but I think we're part of the premise here is that we are acknowledging that additional dollars are needed for the system and trying to figure out as a group what's the most creative way we can do that to achieve the best outcome. Our rebasing proposal for 2007 was designed to close that Medicaid funding gap, to close the gap between costs and rates. And the goal of the system was to create something, as I say, that would reimburse facilities for their actual costs. The rate disparities issue lingers, but one thing that can be said for the proposal that we brought forward was that from one equity standpoint, everybody would have had roughly equivalent cost coverage at least. So even if some facilities were still earning more in absolute dollars for their care, there would have at least been an equity in terms of cost coverage across the state. And it also would have injected more predictability into the system. The rebasing, once rates were fully rebased, every 2 years thereafter they would have been rebased again. And it would have helped us to escape this year-in, year-out struggle, which is a lot of work for all of us, to sort of guess what the rate might be in the rate year next to follow the legislative session. So the rebasing proposal was designed to address the funding shortfall, but in fact, through all of the circumstances that left us with the bill that we finished with, what was enacted by the legislature and signed by the governor is not actually rebasing from a true definitional standpoint, and something else, and actually fails to solve the problem that we were highlighting with the proposal. So with that, just to divide this roughly in half, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Thurlow to describe how the dollars are moving around under the proposal as it did pass and look towards the future a little bit.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, we do want to thank the efforts of those that did stand behind the rebasing proposal that the imperative brought forward. We think there was a lot of discussion around rebasing and nursing facility rates. But as Mr. Lutz has already articulated, the rebasing proposal that actually passed in the final hours of the session, in the final Health and Human Services bill, to put it bluntly, was underfunded. It was stretched out over 8 years. The rebasing will be phased in over 8 years. Contrast that with the rebasing proposal that the imperative originally brought forward, which would have phased in rates over 3 years. It also, we'll talk about specific problems in a moment, but it also does not recognize inflation and indexing of costs. So as a result, if you take a look at slide number 8, which is the second slide on your page 4, that nifty multicolor graph, it really shows what impact that's going to have on nursing facilities across the state in terms of what their rate increases will be over the next several years. 2008, calendar year 2008, is the year one of the 8-year phase-in of rebasing that actually passed. If you look at that bar graph, just to briefly summarize, about 20% of facilities will see a 1% increase or less. If you look to the 2% level, about 50% of facilities will have a 2% or less increase. But the fact of the matter is, while 2008 looks a little bit dismal for facilities, move out to calendar year 2009 and 2010, and not to become overly negative here, but it really becomes a huge problem for facilities. When you look in 2009, a vast majority of facilities will see a 1% or less increase in rates. And in 2010, 100% of facilities will essentially experience a rate freeze. In terms of the funding gap increases that Mr. Liss has already talked about, and as most of you saw from our correspondence on the last night of that session, what essentially passed in the Health and Human Services Bill, while it was recognizing the needs, really fell short of solving and addressing the problem. We move to slide 9. This particular slide summarizes some of the issues that we are experiencing with rebasing or that you'll likely hear from us in the next session. The bill raises a number of issues, but the first, of course, is the phase-in period. There's really no way to cut around it. In order to fund rebasing and to make it work and address the problems, you have to fund it. And because it's stretched over 8 years, it's really going to fail to do the one task it's supposed to do, which is to close the gap between costs and rates. The next issue, though, is indexing of costs and rates. And this was another part of the imperative proposal that was taken out, in large part to deal with other funding priorities of the legislature. But as a result of taking out the recognition of inflation, failure to account for inflation, neither costs nor rates will be adjusted for inflation, especially during that 8-year phase-in. So what that essentially means is that by 2016, when we phase in the rebasing proposal, facilities will have their 2007 costs recognized, finally. You know, when I think of my 2-year-old being, 8 years older and still facilities are being reimbursed at those 2007 costs, you can see that in the future we'll still experience problems. At a minimum, the legislature should update costs during the phase-in period so that rates are not set as 2007 costs for the next 8 years. Mm-hmm. The third issue is specialized care facilities. There's a discrete number of facilities in the state that serve specialized populations. Mr. Held talked about some of those, such as the Rural 80 facilities in his presentation. They serve very unique populations. And the rebasing proposal doesn't address their higher costs associated with their care. And we would encourage the legislature to look at those particular needs of those facilities and address so that there's a payment system that works for those facilities. We're also committed to meeting with the department on some other issues that were passed with regard to rebasing. The closure adjustments that Mr. Hill talked about, the quality component, that there is a quality component that passed subject to some passages from the other tests, and some other issues as well. We're committed to working with the department to try to address those issues and have set up some meetings to try to come to some agreement on some of those issues. Moving to slide 10 then.
Madam Chair,
Representative,
can we take some questions just on that piece of,
yes,
of it? First of all, on the specialized care, there were some rate increase allowance, component increases included in the bill, right, for certain types of specialized care?
Ms. Searle.
Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, I believe you're correct, and I'm going to look to my colleague as well if he has a specific language. I don't know if you
have anything. I don't need the specific language. That's fine. I just wanted to clarify that.
Yep. Just to summarize, for rate years beginning on and after October 1, 2016, the Commissioner is empowered to negotiate rate increases over and above the sort of the cost limits that are in the rebasing proposal. So there's a mechanism there, but it's shut down a number of years.
Okay. And the on this chart that you did with the cost, can you explain that a little? What you mean by under the rebasing language? The percentage increases under the rebasing language?
Madam Chair, Representative Houston, this is reflective of the bill that passed, the 2007 Health and Human Services Bill. This is the estimate of the rate increases that nursing facilities will experience under the phase and period of rebasing as passed by this legislation.
So all of their rate increases?
Right. It's an estimate of the average, it's an estimate of all nursing facility increases. That's right.
Okay. All right, that's good. And I would also just make a comment that the issue of the indexing of costs and rates, I don't think that was just an issue of money. I think that there were some policy considerations, not necessarily here at the legislature, but others involved in negotiations that don't want to put in those things on autopilot, as that word is often used. So just so we have everything, you know, on that issue on the table as well.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Moving to slide 10, this is really the second question that Mr. Lips posed, which is, how can we help facilities transform themselves for the future? It seems that every time the imperative, lobbyists comes before this legislature, we're asked to focus on rates, and in fact, we've been asked to focus on rates and payment system again today. However, we believe that payment issues today will affect the ability to transform the industry to meet the needs of a growing senior population in Minnesota. And so we do look towards the future in discussing how we can align payment systems with transforming to meet growing needs. Slide number 11 introduces you to some of our demand model research, which I know some of you are familiar with, but by way of review, the demand model was a joint research effort put together by the Long-Term Care Imperative that really takes a look at what the demand for older adult services will be and how those needs will be impacted in terms of state resources. It would be a presentation in of itself, and I certainly won't go into detail, but our demand model research briefly shows that there will be a continued need for skill sets. That sometimes has to be said out loud because some people, I think, would hope that nursing facilities may not be needed in the future, but while the role may change for nursing facilities, our demand model does show that there will be a need for skill sets in the future. The typical nursing facility resident is changing. We know that, we see it, and we know that those changes will continue. There will be a growing percentage of residents in our care centers that are short-stay residents, as opposed to some of the previous models where there were longer-term stays. Residents expect a different environment and experience. They are demanding more, a more home-like setting. The physical plants that were created in the 1960s simply don't live up to the expectations of many of the residents. And there are more complex needs. The care that we are providing in care centers today is much more complex than that which was a few decades ago. As Mr. Lips has already talked about, providing higher levels of care to relieve some of the needs that hospitals are filling right now. Care centers are really filling those needs. And because of those changes in the residents that we serve, the physical plant needs of facilities are in need. Facilities are in need of repair, remodeling, and replacement. I believe one statistic shows that by 2010, over half the facilities will be in need of either significant renovation or replacement. So there are significant physical plant needs. But keeping that in mind, we're mindful of some issues that also need to be addressed, technology being key. In order to serve a growing senior population and to meet their demands, technology investments are needed. I'm not going to go into a great deal of detail here, but recognizing that e-health is something that we're very interested in and need to invest in. And then also, we need to invest in the equipment needed to serve these more complex and specialty cares. One example would be to serve an increasing geriatric population in many of our care centers and all the equipment needs that are related to that sort of care. The next slide, slide number 13, raises the issue of property. And like Mr. Held, we're not going to spend a lot of time except recognize that property payment issues are part of the payment system, and that currently the payment options available for nursing facilities to invest in either remodeling or investing in new facilities are, for the most part, insufficient. We, as the Long-Term Care Imperative, are beginning comprehensive discussions that will look at property payments, and we will involve DHS in that as well to discuss those issues and flesh out some solutions. But getting to the last question is, how can we better integrate the payment streams to cover older adult services? Again, as Mr. Lutz introduced this topic, and I think it's also been said for those of you that are involved in the Health Care Access Commission, there's been a recognition that there's a relationship between long-term care and acute care. And we would encourage this group to also take a similarly broad view. We need to address the continuum of care, so from the home and community-based services side to the care center. Our demand model research shows that without a significant investment in home and community-based services, we can expect an even greater need for skilled beds, just to recognize the interrelationship between those two issues. So while we're here focusing on payment issues for care centers today, we need to be mindful that the investment spent on one aspect of the continuum do affect the demands on others. We would also encourage you to look beyond silos between acute care and long-term care, and try to integrate those payment systems as much as possible. Some of the specialized care that we provide in care centers, such as bariatric care, is expensive in nursing facilities, but would be even more expensive in hospitals. So we do, in fact, create some state savings while serving the needs of populations here in the state. So the last slide is some concluding thoughts. And I would just say that as you're considering reimbursement rates for care centers, I would say that state reimbursement policy is really more than just about rates and covering costs in care centers. There are important underlying policy issues that should be openly discussed and debated as we discuss payment issues, and then we would hope that the payment system aligns with the decisions you all need to make as policymakers. We've summarized some of those thoughts here, but we pose the question like this. How do you ensure that seniors have access to the right services at the right place at the right time? Because that's really what we're interested in doing. And payment systems can help address some of those questions. But I won't go and read all those questions that we have for you in slide 16, but we think those are some of the questions that need to be answered as we align payment systems with other solutions to the age wave. Thank you.
Thank you, members. Any questions? Representative Erickson. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Thurlow, what percentage of our nursing home population relies on medical assistance? And on the other hand, do you keep data on how many have invested in long-term care insurance? Ms. Thurlow.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, those are great questions, and I'm sorry, I don't have the answers to those. I guess I'll look to my colleague or maybe to Todd. If you
yeah, we do them. Have our research expert in the room who would have more current data, but I would estimate somewhere in the order of 60% or so, maybe 60% to two-thirds, Todd, does that sound right, of people who are receiving care in nursing facilities are having their care paid for through medical assistance. And then there's another fraction. Sometimes nursing facilities measure the care that they provide in resident days, so take the total number of residents who are served, you know, and you include the number of beds, and you make that calculation that 80% of all of the resident days, meaning one day's worth of service to a resident, that those rates are medical assistance rates. So that includes a portion of people who are paying privately. And as to long-term care insurance, we don't, as an association or as the imperative, track that data. I've heard that Minnesota is doing relatively well compared to some other states, in part because the state itself has encouraged participation. But I think that the penetration for long-term care insurance is still quite low. I would guess in the order of, I maybe shouldn't even hazard a guess, but 10 to 20%, something like that at the max. But Ms. Freeman or others may have better data about that. But it's quite low.
Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Thurlow, Ms. Lipp, what is the average length of stay now in a nursing home, and what do you anticipate it being in the future?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, and I'm going to, again, look at Ms. Phillips in a moment. The median length of stay for a nursing facility based on our demand model is 32 days. I don't know if we have a projection as to what that's going
well,
to get down to.
Yeah, in fact, we just very recently, my colleague again provided a report that the Department of Health issues a data analysis on this issue once a year. And we just looked at the report, and the time frame it would be about 298, I think, was the average length of stay in a nursing facility, and 30 days was the median length of stay. Mm-hmm. And that has gone down dramatically, mm-hmm. and I mean dramatically, over the last 5 to 10 years.
Yes, but could we get that report from your expert that you have?
Yes.
Okay, for all of us?
Yep.
On the National Working Group?
Could
we,
yep.
Thank you.
Does that
help? Representative Hawk has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question that I'd like to address, and I know we've discussed this in the past. What percentage of nursing homes currently are operating under a deficit?
Madam Chair, Representative Hawk, according to our financial survey, depending on which area of the state you're in, but on the statewide average, 30% of nursing facilities are what we would call in financial distress or at risk of closure. And just to explain what that statistic is, it means that they have no cash on hand and I believe are working at a negative 5% operating margin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you kind of touched upon my follow-up question that I want to talk about. Of those 30%, how are they divided up among the geographic groups?
I know you're, Madam Chair, Representative, yes, I know we have distributed in the past a nifty map that shows the regional variations. I do not have that map with me, but the northeast part of the state and the southwest part of the state are those that have the greatest percentage of facilities at risk of closure. The metropolitan area here in the Twin Cities metropolitan area has the least amount of the smallest percentage of facilities at risk of closure, and then there's varieties throughout the different regions. I would be happy to provide that map again for members of this working group.
I might add, Madam Chair,
would you add that?
Partly that reflects that a large number of metro facilities have closed.
Already, thank you. Yes, Representative Thiessen.
Is there, thank you, Madam Chair. On the Medicaid funding, you're talking about allowable costs. And does the state have any control over what those allowable costs be to be, you know, for reimbursement? Or is there ways that, and this maybe you don't need to talk about in detail right now, but think about ways that we could reduce things on the cost side to close that funding gap? Things the state does?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I would have to defer to Mr. Hills, but if you mean, does the state have some say over what things medical assistance will pay for and what things it won't, I think it has some discretion, but it is at the same time constrained by the federal government, sets a lot of conditions on the program.
Right.
So I'm not sure if that was your question. Or
well, and the other question would be if we could come up with some other things that the state does that could close things, close this gap on the cost side as opposed to the spending side.
I wish I had that promotion, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, it's a discussion that I know we're having both at the imperative as well as within MHHA as to how to approach that so that we're not just always asking for rate increases. I think we're still devising whether there's workable solutions that we can come up with, although we're very interested in the Healthcare Access Commission, MHHA. I'll speak for MHHA here, not knowing what my colleague's position is, but we are very interested in the efforts, for example, on providing health insurance for our employees and looking at ways to cover those costs as well. Perhaps there are other costs that we can also look at, but we're certainly interested in engaging in those discussions.
Any other questions for these folks? All right, thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Appreciate it. Members, I want to introduce to you two hardworking nurses. Pat Vincent is the administrator of the nursing home in Representative Bly's hometown, in my hometown, Northfield, and Maureen Graydon is the registered nurse, the director of nurses of that facility, and they are both here today to present. So would you please just introduce yourselves as you speak, and then for the tape, and welcome to committee.
Certainly. Thank you, Representative Fritz. My name is Pat Vincent. I am the CEO Administrator at Freelance Care Center in Northfield. I'm also the chair of the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance. And Maureen?
My name is Maureen Graydon, and I'm Director of Nursing with Pat. I've been at Freelance for 18 years as the Director of Nursing almost all of those years.
And we don't have handouts to you today because we're here to talk from our heart. And so we will do that. My experience began in nursing homes at age 14 as a volunteer, and it was a life-changing opportunity for me as I changed my whole career path. And now I've spent 31-plus years, I'm almost caught up to Bob, health, in older adult services, first as the director of nursing, and since 1991 as administrator. Today I will speak on behalf of my experiences at Freelance Care Center, as well as from the perspective of my colleagues across the state in my role as chair of MHHA. Freelance Care Center is a 102-bed nursing home, and as our previous speakers were talking, I'm just thinking this is what I live every day, talking about the race disparities, the geographic groups, and that kind of thing. At Freelance, we do have a full continuum of services to complement our skilled nursing care. However, we are located 1.2 miles from the line that separates the rural and the metro reimbursement groups. So we are 1.2 miles from the Dakota County line. My concern is that we are reimbursed $23 a day less than what our costs are, so $23 per resident per day, I should say. Last year, our care center showed an operating loss of $100,000. When I arrived at Freelance Care Center 21 years ago as the director of nursing, we had a total of 14 admissions per year. As of today, I checked with my admission director out when I was going out the door. We have experienced 109 admissions already at Freelance Care Center since January 1st. That means we've turned over our entire population plus. The acuity levels, as you heard, are increasing. We have residents who come to us who have been in the hospital for a very short period of time at $500 to $900 per day. The next day they're at the nursing home, and we are getting reimbursed less than $200 a day for most of those residents. We are fulfilling the acute care role that I experienced as I was a young nurse in the hospital setting. And I am gravely concerned about what's going to happen. We're using a nursing home model of the 60s and the 70s. Of course, we've adjusted our staffing patterns according to the case mix levels. However, the model is outdated. We're taking care of gravely ill residents in the nursing home setting. I'm concerned about our staff. We have the old staffing pattern where there's a limited number of registered nurses on the staff, and we are paying them probably $11 an hour than the Northfield Hospital that is just across the county line in Dakota County. We need greater level of assessment skills in our registered nurses because people are coming to us sick. We don't have the support system like you do in the hospital where you have physicians in the house all day long. When we have registered nurses, they have to be able to be of high quality and be able to assess residents correctly. Their responsibility levels are high. I'm very concerned about the future of registered nurses and the availability of them as we go into the future. If you look at the demographics, the average age of registered nurses is about 46 years old. A lot of young people are not going into this profession anymore, and we have to be able to recruit and retain registered nurses. And I could go down the line with the LPNs, with the CNAs, who run into the same kind of difficulty. Certified nursing assistants do a lot of the hands-on care in nursing homes, and it's very difficult to operate without them. And it's very, very difficult when you have a high turnover, so you have different people doing the care weekly. One of my board members made an observation recently in a board meeting that said we really can't be running nursing homes as a business. There's no business person that would continue operating with a negative operating margin and be able to continue to stay in business year after year. We are mission-driven people who, you know, we have a solid core of long-term workers, and they are there because, not because of the money, but because of their passion for caring for the elderly. We each year from the legislature, we get, the last 4 years have been a very meager cost of living increase. It's averaged 1% if you look at the 2 years that were frozen, and then the increases that came the 2 years following. And that is all encumbered. And granted, as a business person and as a former nurse, I'm going to give my staff as much of that wage increase as necessary. In fact, for the last 2 years, we have used reserves to fund some of our operating things related to nursing staffing, or we wouldn't have staff. But, you know, when it's encumbered, we have very little money left to pay the gas, the lights, the food. Equalization ties our hands. You know, we get the same reimbursement as from our private pay clients as we get from the Medicaid system. And, again, it's an area where, as business people, we aren't allowed to run our business. You know, certainly we would be cognizant of the market pressures and that kind of thing, and I don't think there's anybody that would go out there and raise their rates enormously, but we do have to get our costs covered. We have the geographic group disparities, and when we talked about St. Cloud and the Painesville area, when I look at the map, we're in the same ring that those around the metro area as Painesville and St. Cloud. And, you know, it's a very short drive to Apple Valley to get a higher rate of pay when you live in Northfield. As a former nurse, the issue of the quality of care just haunts me as we continue to operate under these conditions. How can we provide quality of care when RNs come and go, LPNs come and go, and CNAs come and go? Our nursing assistant turnover in the first quarter of 2007 was 23%. Last year, it was 83%, and we are on target to head in that same direction this year. We cannot keep staff with a 1% or 1.87% wage increase when their health insurance premiums are going up 40 to 50%. My colleagues, and now I think I will speak from my MHHA chair hat, my colleagues have buildings that are in need of major repairs. I happen to be fortunate enough that we have updated our building in the year 2000, and many of them have fallen down buildings. Some have spent all of their reserves. One of my colleagues said he cashed his last two CDs for his organization this spring, because if you are have a biweekly pay period, there are 2 months in each year that you have to pay your employees three times. One was in May. He cashed his last two CDs. It's coming up again in October. He doesn't know what he's going to do when that month rolls around. Others have line of credit at the bank. They borrow money to cover payroll. And many have downsized to bare-bone support staff. I think when you do this, you know, you're pushing your RNs and your LPNs even harder, and the risk of error is even greater if you're taking away your support staff and putting all the work on the back of your nurses. One of my colleagues recently requested dues forgiveness at the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance, as his organization was recovering from the punitive health department survey. With the penalties that the lack of the ability to admit people in secret occupancy up, and, you know, it was just a bureaucratic mess, and so he's asked us to forgive his dues this year. Mm-hmm. Older Adult Services, I'm really, it breaks my heart to say this, but I do believe Older Adult Services are on target to be the next infrastructure system to collapse in Minnesota. As an administrator, we feel that we are being slowly strangulated, and we don't know if it's the case of the last man standing in this business gets to stay in business, but it is very, very painful each and every day that we go to work. I thank you. I commend all of you for taking your time during this summer season and before the session begins for taking a look at the system and taking a broad perspective and hopefully working with us to help solve the problem. Thank you.
Madam Chairman and members, my most difficult part of my job is managing people with multiple problems, and I must tell you some just some personal stories about what I hear on a daily basis. And this is a typical week for me. I've had one nursing assistant attempt suicide. I have another one threatening suicide. Both of these people have health care insurance with us, but aren't sure that they can continue with that because they have to make some choices about how they're going to spend their money. I have a worker who is dealing with a serious medical problem. She has had a plate in her head from a car accident. She's on our medical insurance. She needs to have more time off, and she has vacation days coming. These people are working for $10 to $12 an hour, and they're working really hard. They're not asking for any handouts from the state. They're really wanting to work, and I feel so bad that I have to cap their top end of their wage. I had one worker come in to me this past week. She's worked for us for 28 years. She's a single mom with two children, one of them going to college this year, and luckily he's smart enough and athletic enough, he's earning a scholarship, but she probably has responsibilities with that particular college student, as you all know, if you've had somebody in college. But she's saying, and she does not own a car, she drives to work. She is the most frugal person I've ever known. She doesn't even go to the Dairy Queen. She knows where every nickel of her check goes. And she says, Marina, I cannot work for $12.50. After 28 years, she makes $12.50. It's top of our wage. She says, I must make $13 in order to survive. I think I can make it if you just give me $13 an hour. Mm-hmm. And it's just heartbreaking day after day to hear people talk about, what kind of choices am I going to have to make? She says, I think I need to start worrying about retirement. She's been meeting with our 403B retirement planners, and she says, I don't have any money to put into that plan. So how do I make those choices? These are day-to-day questions and problems when people come to us, and we don't have very good answers for them. I've appreciated the scholarship program. I'm a huge advocate for promoting people hiring, improving their education. I've had most of my CNAs who are able. The previous worker I'm telling you about is not one of those people who would be capable of going to school. And many people who are nursing assistants can't go to school. This is their vocation. But most of the people, I believe all the people we have given scholarships to, which have been at least 2 a year, maybe more, I have lost to other facilities as they've, I have not had long-term employees from any of these scholarships, I'll have to tell you. I have not discouraged it because of that statistic, but I must say it's not helping our numbers in any way. It makes them a better worker while they're there, but they all go out and, as Pat said, just a few miles away, they're being offered more money and incentives. And I have been very lucky. I haven't had to use any pool workers. That's been wonderful. I have a lot of long-term, very, very devoted staff. However, I have a nurse who's worked for us for 25 years, and she said, I have to pick up another part-time job. Is there any way I can pick up some overtime with our facility? These are, every day I hear more and more problems, and I just need to be able to give them some hope that we're going to be able to give them maybe more than just a 1% increase in their checks in the near future. So I appreciate you listening to me tell my top story, Madam Chairman and members, and hopefully through some committee work this could be helpful.
Well, thank you both for your presentation, your testimony. I do have just a couple of questions, and they're, I think, of interest to the members, and I'll be brief. In your nursing home, you have a registered nurse and LPNs and your certified nursing assistants. Could you give us the ratio as to how many residents the nursing assistant gets up or is in charge of caring for in an 8-hour shift, and then the LPN and the RN overall?
Madam Chairman, I can do that in a general sense. Each shift is different, but on the normal shift days and evenings, a nursing assistant would be responsible for about 10 to 12 residents to get up in the morning and get ready for the day, and same thing at the other end of the day as well. And on that, we would say on a wing where there's about 20 residents, there would be one LPN who would be passing the medications and doing all the treatments for that particular resident wing. And then we will have one or two RNs overseeing those wings, depending on their particular capacity. So in the evening shift, I cannot find a nurse who can supervise that shift. There are no RNs that want to work in a nursing home in the evening shift. I'll have to tell you that. If you find one, it's just amazing, but it is very hard. You lead on your very strong LPNs, and they have helped us through our evening and night shifts, but it's very hard to attract an RN.
Any questions, members? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you will, what percentage of your budget pays for administration, you know, for you and for others? Because I always deal with this, you know, at the local level, from my very dear employees who talk about the highly paid administrators within our nursing homes, and yet they're getting, you know, $12 an hour, let's say.
Ms. Benson.
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, I don't have that number in the top of my head. I can certainly get that for you, but I think in my organization, our administration is fairly lean. Yeah, we are lean because we do have the full continuum of care, and so I wear a lot of hats.
Does that answer your question? Any other questions of these two? All right, thank you very much. Appreciate you coming from Northfield. Thank you. Members, while the folks are coming up, I just want to mention also that we are going to continue our nursing home working group. We're taking it on the road. So we will be meeting in Faribault, Minnesota, my hometown, at St. Lucas Care Center next month. And we had a date down, but we've had a problem with scheduling. So that's going to change, and we'll keep you advised. It's looking as though it would be our September 17th or 18th. And that's, again, at the St. Lucas Care Center in Faribault, Minnesota. And the address is 500 First Street Southeast. And Brad Mulgard, our administrator there, has invited us and will host us there from 2 to 4. And I will, Jen and I will email you and get back to you. And we are inviting all of the surrounding nursing homes, again, we extend an invitation to Ms. Vincent and Graydon to join us and bring others if they have an interest. So with that then, I will turn it over to Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Iris Freeman, and this summer I passed the 30-year mark in the long-term care field as an ombudsman, a trainer, an agency director, and advocate for persons with Alzheimer's disease. There are already two witnesses and a chair who will say 30 years, big deal.
It is a big deal.
With me is Dr. Holly Roden, Senior Field Researcher for the Service Employees International Union. Together we're representing seniors and workers for quality, made up of AARC, the Alzheimer's Association, the Elder Care Rights Alliance, the Nurses Association, the National Association of Social Workers in Minnesota, and the Union Coalition of Long-Term Care Workers. Our coalition formed in 1999 because seniors and workers have a shared stake in the issue of nursing home staffing. And that staffing is highly dependent, as you've heard so many times already this afternoon, on the issue of nursing home reimbursement. I'm going to provide testimony, by and large, from the seniors' perspective, and Holly will provide greater detail about the effect of reimbursement methods and levels on direct care workers. Staffing is a kind of antiseptic word to use for the ways that working short can look to residents and families. Think instead about a nursing home resident who has always been a shy and fastidious and proud person who has to be shamed by soiling a bed because every available nursing assistant was helping somebody else at the moment. Think instead about being a nursing home resident with caregivers so hurried and worried about their own families that getting a smile and some chit-chat may be out of the question. Think instead about how concerned family members respond when they arrive to find mom fiddling with her food, mashing the sauerkraut into the ice cream, and having no one to help her that day. It's also an opportunity for me to highlight that much of this matter relates to public payment. Seniors are also direct payers for nursing home services, paying from their life savings as long as the money lasts. People can be in their nursing home lives, both private pay residents and medical assistance recipients. Like public payers, these payers desire good value. And seniors organizations have long argued that private payers shouldn't be forced to make up for the insufficiency in home stay payments either through surcharges that are imposed in order to attract additional federal money, or by allowing nursing homes to charge an unequalized rate to charge residents perhaps whatever the market will bear while accepting a lower rate from DHS. Seniors and workers this afternoon want quickly to convey three messages. One is that mending the nursing home reimbursement crisis can't be done right without planning a sound long-term care system for the future cohort of older Americans. Two, quality care and quality jobs are inseparable. And three, achieving value in the system requires staff retention and training because turnover alone wastes precious dollars. As you can see, some of these themes are starting to achieve the desired pylon at this point in the afternoon. Let me say a little bit more about each of these. First, nursing home reimbursement is a big issue to tackle, but we can't make good policy for nursing home payments and their share of the budget without having clearer plans for what role Minnesota nursing homes will play in the future. No, we didn't practice. There has been downsizing, a bit planned, but mostly a result of other economic factors and other social factors. Sometimes the downsizing looks like an unstated policy of starving the beast. Don't put out that milk. The cats will come back. We can do better. We absolutely can. And seniors are clear about their preferences for community care wherever possible. But while everybody nods ahead to say, yes, oh, yes, we want to do this, the state plan for building the infrastructure for this newer long-term care system, the one that will serve us, that's largely at the talking stage. And what we're talking about is the trained workforce to work independently, widely dispersed in communities, and the services that are needed. Two, quality care and quality jobs are inseparable goals for us and for many in this room, I know. We can't continue to do what we're doing in nursing home or in community care on the guess that there is an unending supply of people, mostly women, who will do these jobs for little reward, at least for a while. There's an important role that reimbursement plays in creating quality jobs. And that's not the whole of it, we know. I mean, every reimbursement system, whether or not it's called an incentive system, has incentives. And it takes not only the system, but expert employers to make the most of them. My favorite reimbursement incentive lesson comes from a Medicaid director in another state. She directed Medicaid in both Illinois and Florida. She led the development of a quality incentive reimbursement method. And word got out that the homes that had tropical fish tanks were getting good scores. So all of a sudden, there was this proliferation of tropical fish tanks everywhere. In the better facility, the fish did fine, and in the struggling ones, well, I think the term is going up. Third, a real value-producing nursing home reimbursement system is needed more than ever because we're caught in this tide where there isn't enough money in the system for dramatic improvements. And some of the money we are spending is wasted on the cost of turnover and repairing the effects of inadequate care. A shorter way to say this is we're saving now and paying later. And while it's quite modern to talk about outcomes in resident care and to base reimbursement systems on them, I think what we're doing today, finally, is considering the outcomes of the reimbursement system we have now. Low satisfaction by operators, by residents, by families, by workers. Using Stevie's turnover model for turnover survey for the American Healthcare Association, Hollis Turnham a few years ago calculated that Minnesota had spent in that year $54 million on turnover. She calculated using 30,200 certified nursing assistants with, at that time, a 51% average turnover rate and estimating about $3,500 each direct and indirect cost for persons leaving the job. And especially alarming is that the highest turnover rate is in the first 90 days because people are so often unprepared technically and emotionally for this draining, heavy, demanding job. We can end this cycle. And it's, right now, it's a turnstile, except for those very, very long-staying workers, a turnstile of hiring, quick training, changing schedules, changing assignments, not enough support, not enough supervision, not a whole lot of peer support. Everybody's busy. And what do you get? Absence, tardiness, not lack of motivation, and of course, termination or quitting. We believe in research support, that investments in health insurance and in training are going to make a real difference in turnover rates. And we're so glad that the insurance issue is getting the attention it deserves this interim. We are very grateful as well for that scholarship program, and it is a good start, but it's not enough to build that infrastructure of long-term care workers for the demanding needs of future residents and the demanding needs of community care individuals. That scholarship is great. We need more. It is sad to respond to people who call proposals for training a slap in the face of the workers, a punishment for the workers. You're going to make them learn things. On the contrary, it's a way to build skills and also a career in healthcare. Quoting Stephen Dawson's PHI testimony, Healthcare Institute testimony to the Federal Institute of Medicine this June, creating an organizational culture that values training both technical and relational sends a message to paraprofessional workers that their development is important and that the entire facility or agency is committed to improving job performance and the work environment. In addition, it leads to quality care. With the chair's permission, I will exceed my 10 minutes by three paragraphs in the hope that my colleague will have her fair share of time.
Thank you.
May I?
Yes.
Looking back those 30 years, I want to say that regardless of our lofty goals at the beginning of each budget session, we seem only to tweak the system each time, a bit of a cola at best. Our 2007 Seniors and Workers for Quality legislative proposal, carried by Representative Fritz, expressed our priorities. It was our shopping list, the needed COLA, money to raise staffing levels, a recognition that the cost of behavioral care has been underestimated in our rates, a thoughtful approach to rebasing, a proposal to open health care access to workers, and a proposal for system-wide workforce development. The result in 2007, the same as all too often. Most of the objectives dropped away. The insurance dropped away. The staffing dropped away. The training dropped away to get the COLA we could get, which didn't exactly resemble the COLA that was requested, plus a rebasing method that misses the mark. There is a better rate intended for dementia care, but it'll take 8 years, and by then some of us will have been on Medicare for six. So long as we maintain a prospective payment rate, a prospective payment method, which is explicitly intended to keep costs down, it's very important to have a quality component. Otherwise, it's too easy for cost savings to be realized as cuts to quality. But we have to do better than we've been doing. We should incorporate minimum staffing in the rates, because those requirements do affect behavior. We should assure that homes can staff up without having to lower wages and benefits or defer other necessary expenses. We should get more savvy about measuring staffing level retention and staffing pool use, and we should certainly also measure the less tangible elements of training, support, teamwork, leadership, and morale. We recognize the struggle it is to talk about potential new spending when the nursing home sector of Minnesota's budget, all the sources, can be expressed in billions. But we must always bring the question back to what valuable attention and services have to be delivered to nursing home residents who cannot care for themselves. And I would also ask that we keep in mind that a typical nursing home day in some facilities at $135 is about the price of a night at a Minneapolis Holiday Inn. And we expect a whole lot more nurturing care than clean sheets and a chocolate on the pillow.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I didn't quite expect that by the time I got to my testimony that pretty much everything I was going to say somebody has already said. But I do have some additional stuff that might be helpful. So let me start with the detailed stuff, and then I just want to take a couple of minutes to maybe talk about a sort of a different view of what the reimbursement system can do. So there's been a lot of discussion about wages and what the current reimbursement system does in terms of affordability of people working there, and there's a handout that I think was in your folder.
Mm-hmm. Doctor, could you introduce yourself?
Is Dr. Holly Rose, and I'm with the Service Employees International Union. One of the things I just wanted to point out on this wage stuff, with a number of different testifiers have already raised, is a major issue in terms of retaining highly valued qualified staff. But this is a comparison of a report that the Jobs Now Coalition put out in terms of what people need to earn for a basic needs budget. And what's important to keep in mind is when we're talking a basic needs budget, we're talking really basic. And when we're talking housing, transportation, energy, for the housing, food, health care, although it's based on not particularly affordable health care. There's nothing in here for, and child care, I'm sorry, but there's nothing in terms of savings, retirement, children's education. So it's very, very bare bones. And one of the things I did was, they list down for each of these reasons, and I apologize to the members that are here that aren't officially on the committee. I might have missed your reason by mistake. You can see that for two working adults with two children up in Region 1, for instance, and the counties are listed, you need to make at least $9.75 just to do your basic needs budget. If you're a single parent with two kids, you need $13.35. I went to the DEED website and looked at their wage salaries for long-term care workers, and those are listed in the column over on the right side. These are averages for either the region up on top or specific counties, and you can see that they some come close if you have two working adults, But in terms of a single parent with children, they're nowhere close to even doing a basic needs budget. So for people who are, you know, asking specifically around wage rates and all, this is just to give you an idea of how big a gap there is. I mean, if you look at Region 7E, for instance, for a single parent with two kids, you need to earn about $20 an hour just for a basic needs budget. And for long-term care workers, it's just over half that that people are earning. So what our current reimbursement system is providing for is subsistent wages, which you've heard stories about already, unaffordable health insurance. So either people are going uninsured or underinsured, and there's already been discussion around what a problem that is for folks. But the one thing I guess I wanted to leave people with is sort of the idea of thinking about a reimbursement system that produces value for the residents, and think about value in terms of cost per health outcome. Now, I know that even though people are in nursing homes for a reason, they're not, I don't want to insult anybody, they're not the healthiest people, right? But that's not to say that there's not a level of wellness that we should strive for. You know, I mean, the basic level is sort of a dignity level, but better than that, we really should do as well for the residents as possible. And I'm not sure that the reimbursement system that now exists, even with the changes that have gone into effect in terms of the quality incentives, are going far enough to really look at how we produce value for residents. And I think that that's an important touchstone for people to keep in mind when they think about the reimbursement system. The idea that, you know, without enough staffing, you're going to have more incontinence, you're going to have more malnutrition, you're going to have more dehydration, those all add costs as people get hospitalized. So I just think that the issue of value is very important, and I think this is the bottom line. This isn't going to come to any shock to any of you sitting around the table, but the reimbursement as it exists now simply isn't adequate to do anything that I think the people here want to see it done. It's not adequate for staffing levels. It's not adequate for paying qualified staff. It's not adequate for training staff. But fundamentally, it's not adequate for providing the value that the residents deserve when decisions are made that they end up living in these facilities. So I guess that's really all I'd want to add into the discussion as you continue deliberations for the rest of the interim before session.
Yes. Representative Erickson. Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, what percentage of our nursing home employees are unionized?
I am embarrassed to say that I... Oh, say that again?
About
20%. About 20%. Thank
you. Representative Otremba.
Can you repeat the basic need that you
yes.
included in that number?
I will, and I'll okay, the basic needs budget includes food, housing, health care, clothing, transportation, and child care. It doesn't include any money for emergencies, retirement, children's education, vacations, entertainment, or anything sort of extra that we would consider to be nice to have.
So is like fuel and electricity included in the housing or the...
Yes, the housing would include your rent and your utilities, and transportation would include your fuel costs.
And so I'm on this commission to end poverty, so I'm looking at all these stats, and these seem low, so I don't know what, but that's okay.
Well, I mean, I think Madam Chair, Representative Rotunda, there are other numbers that are out there that speak more to a livable wage, which obviously are higher because they would include all the things that this doesn't include, but this really is just about basic needs.
Representative Houston, did you have a question?
No.
Other members with any questions for these two folks? All right. Well, thank you very much for the information that you gave us, and thank you to all of our presenters today for all of this important information that you shared with us. And that was the purpose of this hearing, was to gather and share information, and I, for one, have learned a great deal and hope to
continue to learn and share this. And so we'll see you all, we hope, in Faribault, Minnesota in October, the latter part of October. And members, before you leave, I want you to look in your packet for this, your reimbursement sheet for you to fill out and hand in to Jen McNerney. Thank you. Thank you all for coming.